Santa Montefiore, welcome to Jazz FM. What a beautiful book.
Thank you so much.
The Beekeeper's Daughter. Now, I really love the way the story unfolds, but it's safe to say I don't want to give away too many surprises by explaining what it's about.
Yeah.
So in your own words, but be very careful not to reveal too much.
I know.
Could you share with us what it's about?
Yes, it's so difficult talking about a novel when obviously there are twists and turns in the book that you can't give away. And so I suppose in a nutshell, it's two parallel love stories, one just during the Second World War and one in the 70s. It's a daughter and mother relationship. It's two women, one searching for a lost love and one finding a new love. And I can't give much more away than that. It's based in England on a beautiful estate in Hampshire, and in America on an island that I based on Nantucket, actually. But because I don't know Nantucket well enough to base a book there, in that people are very quick to write in and complain and say, actually, in 1945 on Nantucket Island, this did not happen. So I made the island my own. I called it Tekanasset, which is just a play on the letters in Nantucket, really. So it's an island off Massachusetts in America in the 70s, and Dorset in the war, in the Second World War, in the 40s.
I said when
Dorset, Hampshire, sorry.
It's okay.
I get so confused. It's my 15th book.
I thought it was Dorset. I thought you said
it. It might be Dorset. It probably is Dorset. I've written 15. I'm on my 16th now.
Oh, wow.
So I think that's my 14th, actually. I go with the years. So I wrote it last year, so it's coming out in paperback now. So yes, it's my 14th novel. And I get so confused because they're all based in different places. So that one is based in Dorset. You're absolutely right.
And when I first met you outside, I said to you that it had a kind of feel of Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility about it, a kind of olden days feel.
Yeah, it does. I'm quite an old-fashioned person and I love those old-fashioned books. I like basing novels during the war, for example, the Second World War. Communication was very difficult. It was easy for people to lose each other. It was hard to communicate and things got lost in, you know, letters were misinterpreted or even letters got lost, and it's very easy to lose people. And I like that. I think now it's very hard with communication. If somebody wants to disappear, for example, now, quite hard. It's very easy to track people down. Back in the 40s, also, you're very much, as a woman, you're very duty-bound to marry somebody from your own class, whatever that is, your own religion. I mean, I married a Jew. I'm Christian, brought up going to church, and my family were very accepting of my husband, and I converted to Judaism and we married in a synagogue and nobody raised an eyebrow. You could not have done that back in the war. In fact, my grandmother, she died before we got married, but she was very I wouldn't say upset, but she was a bit surprised that I was going out with a Jew, and she certainly thought that was quite unacceptable, really. So, yeah, even then, you know, in her day, it would have been unacceptable to have married somebody out of your world, I think. So it gives me a lot of fodder to work with as a writer.
It's called The Beekeeper's Daughter, and it's fair to say that the bees are of paramount importance to this story. I felt they were, anyway. How much did you know about bees before you started writing this book?
I knew nothing about bees, except I adore the English countryside, and I have a cottage on my parents' farm in Hampshire, because I based the novel on my own cottage, which a few summers ago we had a swarm of bees that attached itself to the outside of my cottage. And I saw this huge, massive ball of, I didn't know what it was, the seething mass. And then I got closer, I saw they were bees. I was absolutely fascinated. And my father has hives on the farm that a local beekeeper keeps them there. And so we called him, and actually he sent his daughter over. And she said that in the evening when it gets cool, they form a cluster like that. They're looking for a hive and they're protecting their queen. So they're waiting to find somewhere that they can then build a home. And she could, because they were all sleepy, she could literally scrape them off and put them into a basket and take them home and put them in a hive, either introduce them to, you know, a hive that she already has or a new hive. It's quite complicated, the whole bee thing. You can't just go and throw them in with are the bees. Anyway, in the morning, they were swarming around the cottage. We couldn't leave the house because there were thousands and thousands of them. The air was black with these bees and my children were gripped. And I thought beekeeper's cottage sounded good, the beekeeper's cottage. So I thought, well, I'll base a book around that. And then, of course, it turned into The Beekeeper's Daughter. But I had to do a lot of research about bees.
And so you know lots about them now.
I know lots about them.
They're quite popular, aren't they? Because last year there was a whole thing, sort of like Spring Yes. Watch, that then turned into Bee Watch.
I think people love bees because obviously the honey is delicious. They're very happy to share the honey. They're not like wasps that go and steal honey. They're pretty, they're cute. My daughter, she as a little girl would put a bumblebee on her arm and let it walk up her arm. She loved doing that, and I was always terrified she was going to get stung. She never got stung once. She just loved having big fat bumblebees walking up her arm, which I put in the novel. But they are, they're fascinating, they're sweet, and YouTube was brilliant, internet was brilliant, books were brilliant. Weirdly, though, I find the universe always conspires to help me when I'm writing a book in a very weird, wonderful way. I was watching my son playing football, and I ended up talking to a grandmother who was watching her grandson, and she said, oh, you're the writer, oh, I've read your books, what are you working on now? And I said, I'm writing about a beekeeper during the war. She goes, oh, I said a beekeeper's daughter during the war. She says, oh, that's so funny. I was a beekeeper's daughter during the war. My father was a beekeeper in the 40s.
Good gracious.
Isn't that extraordinary? And then she sent me a book and she helped me a lot. And I've written her into the dedication, you know, to thank her.
Actually, I noticed in the dedication that you quote many people as angels that have come your way. You've
I
obviously put it out
you,
there.
Do you just ask for help? Do you know what? Even if you don't believe it, because my husband thinks I'm mad, because I ask the parking angel for parking places. And my husband thinks I'm mad. And my children imitate me and make fun of me. But actually, you don't even have to believe. Just try it. It's fascinating what comes up. You know, I once needed I went to bed one night saying I need a detective to help me work out the plot. There was this very complicated plot for The House by the Sea, and I couldn't work out how to join these two stories. And I said, I need a detective. Please, angels, just help me find a detective. The following morning, I was dropping my children off at school. This man on a bicycle waved at me. And when he took off his mask and everything, he was an old friend from university I hadn't seen for 15, 20 years. And he worked for Kroll, the big private investigators company. And we went and had lunch and he sorted out my plot.
How lovely.
I know. So it does work. You just have to ask.
Well, the story covers the years in the lead up to the Second World War and continues during the war years themselves and beyond. But it's those war years that have Rufus, one of the main characters, writing letters from the front where he's fighting to Grace, who's at home in England. What you get is a couple of lines from a letter that really affects Grace, but actually is really emotional for the reader as well. The noise of war is so great it destroys all living things. Sometimes I feel that Earth herself has stopped breathing altogether, because when I sit under the stars and see nothing but my own fears, I try to hear her breathe in and out, and hear nothing but a deathly silence and my own weak heart beating still for my one and only true love. It kind of gets you there, but you weren't around during the Second World War. So how did you get the tone right? It sounds so genuine. Did you have some help with that?
No, I tell you, I love nature. So the breathing in and out of nature for me, I live on a farm in Hampshire most of the time, and we have these beautiful bluebell woods. If I'm sitting in those woods and I'm really listening, you can hear the trees breathing, you can hear the rustling, the tweeting of birds, the scratching of a squirrel going up a tree. It's extraordinary if you really, really listen. Most of us are listening to our thoughts and thinking about what we have to do tomorrow. If you actually sit and really alertly is not a good word, but if you really listen in an alert way, it's fascinating what you can hear. So Rufus, he loves the countryside and he's very connected with nature, and he teaches Grace to listen to the breathing in and out of nature. So when I was thinking about him on the front, and I've read Birdsong, one of my favourite books, and I've also been working at the moment on a book during the War of Independence in Ireland. So I've been quite into war a bit recently. And I sort of, you just have to imagine what must it be like. You look at these photographs of these landscapes that are so bleak and everything is dead. There's nothing growing. It's winter. It's cold. The earth is hard. There's no trees. There's no birds. There's nothing. It's dead. And I thought, well, Rufus would feel, because I know that I would feel that terrible sense of desolation of not being connected to that fabulous vibration that is the living, breathing world of trees and flowers and plants. So I just put myself in his shoes and thought, what must it be like to be faced with, A, the possibility of your own death, but the bleakness of dead world, dead nature, dead earth. And that's how I
think. It was a really nice point in the book, in terms of, nice isn't a good word to use, but it just made me stop. I had to stop for a little while and just take a gulp. And
well, do you know, I write instinctively. I don't think very hard about what anybody's going to think about what I write. I just write to sort of tell the story. And it's interesting hearing from readers what appeals to them, you know. And I've written, there was a novel that I wrote, which the beginning of it's in London, and it's very much society women and they're sort of lunching. And a lot of my readers wrote to me and said, it wasn't till the book got into South Africa that I got carried away. The beginning didn't really work for me, they said. And I sort of get it, because I think what people love about, or what people enjoy about my books is nature, is being in these wonderful places. They don't really want to be in a city and going to the Caprice for lunch.
The Beekeeper's Daughter, I thought, would make a brilliant film. When you're writing, do you see the characters' faces?
Yes. And do you know what I do now, actually, which helps enormously, is I put pictures of actors on my computer, people who I would cast. It just helps me develop the characters according to a certain sort of vibration, I suppose. Rupert Everett's a great friend of mine, and I channeled him for Rufus, funnily enough, because he's got that very chiselled aristocratic face. He's got that wonderful voice with those very clipped vowels, and he's got a very sweet way he chuckles. He lifts his shoulders and sort of chuckles in a rather sweet, self-deprecating way. And so I channeled him for Rufus, funnily enough, and I did tell him that I was going to do that and hoped that he would like the character. But yeah, I do sometimes think of actors, and I'm very visual in my imagination. I am taken every time I sit at my desk on an adventure into a different world. I'm really there.
Well, I was going to ask you to cast it. You've already told us
I've cast
about
it
Rufus,
already, yes.
But tell me about Grace. Who's going to play Grace?
Grace, do you know, I'm very bad at the women. I'm really good at the men. You see, I think Eddie Redmayne would make a great Freddy. I think now he's won an Oscar, he'd be too expensive. I don't think that would work. The women, I'm not so good with the women. I don't know who the women would be.
Was there a lot of Grace? Was there a lot of yourself in Grace?
Much more of me in Grace than in Trixie, definitely. There was a 60s model with long hair and a fringe that somebody like the Shrimp, Jean Shrimpton, somebody like her, I thought Trixie, that would be good for Trixie in the, you know, in the 70s. Grace is much more like me, so I probably didn't have to think of an actress, because I probably just thought of me.
This is your 16th book.
This one is my 15th. Sorry.
15th.
Or is it my 14th? No, it's my 14th. My 15th comes out this year in July, and the new one I'm writing now is my 16th, so I'm on my 16th
okay,
now.
This is book number 14.
Yes, 14.
I read that you are rather fond of... Now, I don't know whether you're very fond or you've been compared to Mary Wesley, because I love Mary Wesley.
Oh, I was compared to Mary Wesley and Rosamund Pilcher. That was because I wrote about Cornwall.
Right.
And they both, the Camomile Lawn and Rosamund Pilcher, also wrote about Cornwall.
Mary Wesley didn't write her first book until she was 74.
I know.
But every single book she wrote was adapted for television.
I know, so, and they're brilliant.
Are any of yours yet?
No, not yet. I've had people sniffing around, especially the French Gardener, and... You know, the odd interest here and there, but nothing.
I think this is perfect.
I would love a book to be made into a movie. I tell you what is really funny is if you go onto YouTube and you've got nothing better to do, just type in Meet Me Under the Ombu Tree, which is my first novel. And there are two fans who have done a kind of pastiche of movies to music and made it into a trailer for that. If there was a movie about Meet Me Under the Ombu Tree, those would be the trailers. And I think one's in Italian, one's in Spanish. And they're hilarious, because it's just extraordinary that anyone would do that. And I love looking at them, because I think, oh, you know, I can see my characters and see them moving and breathing. I'd love to see my characters moving, you know, in animation. It'd be such fun to see the adaptation. It'd be horrible if they got it all wrong and annoyed me, but I'd still like it to be done.
Earlier you talked about nature, and just a moment ago you said that you have sometimes pictures of actors or actresses to, that help you visualise whilst you're writing, but you listen to music as well, don't you?
Absolutely. Do you know, I find it very hard to write now without having a playlist of music. I play the same music over and over again. I'm listening to David Arkenstone at the moment for my Irish trilogy, and I listen to the same playlist over. You'd think I'd get bored of it, but I don't. It takes me right back into the book. I tell people when they look at me in surprise and say, how can you possibly write to the distraction of music? If you watch, for example, Out of Africa, and there's Robert Redford and Meryl Streep in the aeroplane, they're flying over the plains of Africa, and she puts her hand back and they hold hands. That's a moment when this huge rush of emotion sort of floods into my chest and I sob. If you take the music out, it's flat. Nothing. You don't feel anything. So for me, when I write, if I listen to music, the big movie soundtracks, for example, Lord of the Rings, Rob Roy, those wonderful, very deep and passionate and stirring music pieces, I'm transported into the moment. I feel what my characters are going through. It drives me deeper, I think, so I can really feel the sorrow or the longing or the heartbreak, whatever it is. It really helps.
You've got a rather lovely website that is simply santamontefiore.com.
Yes.
There are some pictures of nature. There's pictures of you with your dog. but there are also some bits on books. Now, I don't know whether you have a favourite author, do you?
I have lots of favourite authors, actually. I'm quite diverse. I'll love, for example, Sarah Waters' Fingersmith, I think is one of the best plots I've ever read. I loved, you know, The Secret Life of Bees and The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd, beautifully written. And then I'll enjoy something like George R. R. Martin. I've read all the Game of Thrones, very different. Brilliantly written. I think he's a genius. So I like, you know, lots of different sorts of books. Actually.
You recommend on your website Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane. Tell us about that.
Gosh, it's a very weird book, but it sucks you in. It's totally compelling. It's very simply written. And I think actually to write in that simple way isn't easy. You know, sometimes it's very easy to overwrite and be very flowery. To write in that very simple way that somehow manages to mesmerize the reader and pull them in is rather extraordinary. And it's about this child, it's this little boy. I have a little boy, so I can identify. And this woman comes to look after him. And he knows that she's like a witch. She's absolutely vile. But the father thinks she's wonderful and the parents think she's wonderful and she's ghastly. And it's magic, you know, and there's this family at the bottom of the lane who have clearly been there for centuries and centuries. But although it's very much fantasy, it's written in a way that makes it very ordinary and very contemporary. And you don't feel when you're reading it that it's fantasy at all. You really believe that these people are... that you just believe in these people. It's like, yes, it's an absolutely extraordinary. He creates an extraordinary world. And there is this pond, a little puddle, really, in this garden at the bottom of the lane where this rather extraordinary family of women, it's quite confusing because you sort of don't know whether they're real, whether the woman is an old woman and a young woman simultaneously, because it's weird.
But worth checking out.
Yes, but that pond is like an ocean. Right. Because when they fall into it, it's an ocean, but it's a pond. It's very weird, but I actually really would recommend it. It's not just for children. I would say actually adults will get more out of it. But I suppose it's one of those many layered books that children can enjoy and adults.
Back to the beekeeper's cottage. Sure. My favourite character is Arthur, Grace's father.
Oh, I love Arthur. He's very like my father, because my father's a farmer. And in every one of my books, I do put my father. I don't do it consciously, but if there's ever a wise old man, greying, very in touch with nature, very in touch with the seasons, very philosophical and deep, it's always my father. So Arthur is very like my father.
Like the Alfred Hitchcock thing of him appearing in all of his
films
as well.
Absolutely. Maybe if they make the movie, I'll just put Dad in it.
So The Beekeeper's Daughter is out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster UK. It is fantastic to meet you. And it was a really lovely read in front of the fire on a cold winter's day.
Well, that's what it's for. You know, I write to escape. I sit in my office in London and it's grey and dreary outside, and I disappear into a world of, pleasure and excitement, and just take me off somewhere nice. So I hope my readers also enjoy being taken off somewhere different.
Santa Montefiore, thank you so much.
Well, pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Nice to meet you.